Paul Winchell is known for throwing his voice. Now he's throwing out a new idea, adding ventriloquism to the kiddie curriculum. He's also the author of his autobiography, which is called Winch, which is published by First Books, and he joins us on the line right now. Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine, Peter. How are you? It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
It's a pleasure to talk to all of the members of the Anthill Mob.
Okay.
I grew up hearing your voice time and time again as a kid, and of course a lot of children grew up when you created the voice of Tigger and Winnie the Pooh cartoons.
Yes, I did Tigger, and I did a lot of stuff for Hanna-Barbera. I did Dick Dastardly and Muttley.
Right.
And I did Gargamel on the Smurfs, and a number of animated characters that I'm sure the youngsters remember, and now they're baby boomers.
Absolutely. But let's go back even further, because, you know, you first came to fame as a ventriloquist, and I read somewhere where you were hoping to see that make a resurgence, because you don't come across too many ventriloquists today.
Well, I think the problem is that the art itself is sort of faded out because computers came into the picture. And now everything that you see on television talks. Not only characters that talk, but objects, toilet seats, perfume, almost everything. And the animation has become so sophisticated lately that I don't think the youngsters are really aware of what a ventriloquist is, because most of the voices that they hear are done by actors who are off the screen.
Like yourself as a scrubbing bubble?
Right, when I did those characters. But when I was on screen, that back in those days, of course, they understood that when they saw the little dummy on my knee and that he appeared to be talking, that I was actually doing the talking without moving my lips. That's the part of ventriloquism that I don't think the children today really understand. So what I've tried to do is kind of bring back those shows so that the youngsters can now see them on their computers.
And we should mention, speaking of computers, you have a website which is www.paulwinchell.com. That's www.paulwinchell.com. How did you first come into ventriloquism?
Well, I was, of course, a great admirer of Edgar Bergen. I don't know how many people remember. I know the old-timers remember Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and they were just a sensation back in my time on radio because we didn't have any television, and it was really a phenomenon that a ventriloquist would be such a smash on a medium where you couldn't see him.
Yes.
But nonetheless, Bergen was every Sunday night on the Chase and Sanborn Hour. We used to sit tuned to the radio and listen to this wonderful artist and Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd and all of his characters fascinated me so much that I decided that I would like to try to be like him. And I bought a booklet that he had written, and I was surprised that I learned it rather quickly, in spite of the fact that many ventriloquists will tell you that you have to be born with a certain kind of vocal cords, or it's a particular gift. But that's really a lot of malarkey. Anybody can become a ventriloquist if they actually are interested enough in the subject to spend the time that's necessary.
Now, two of your famous characters would be Jerry Mahoney.
Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead Smith.
Knucklehead Smith, yes. And I'm just curious to know, as a ventriloquist, how do you find your voice? And by that I mean, do you have the dummy, you look at it, and it takes on a personality and you add to it, or do you create a voice first and find the dummy to go along with it? How does that work?
Well, it's an interesting question, Peter, because with Jerry, the first dummy that I had, it was completely a different situation. I had to do, as you said, to find a voice for him. But the second character, Knucklehead, worked just in reverse, because once I was already established on television, we used to do dialogue where Jerry would talk about this youngster in school named Knucklehead, and I got so many letters that people wanted to see this Knucklehead that the problem now suddenly came, what would a young man who had earned the name Knucklehead look like and sound like. So I had to sit down and build a dummy that reflected that kind of a nickname, and also create the voice and the character, because a knucklehead, where you would assume is a guy who is kind of a little bit slow and a little bit bashful, and that kind of gave me the clue for his character, where Jerry was created first, and I actually patterned myself slightly after the Charlie McCarthy mode by making him a brash, fresh little youngster. And then as time went on, I developed my own character for him. But that's an interesting question. Which comes first, the dummy or the character?
Now, you grew up, as you said, listening to Edgar Bergen.
Right.
But your career took off, and I'm sure he must have been aware of you. What was it like? You must have come in contact with the man.
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful experience that I'll never forget. There was a show on the air, I don't know if you remember, called Masquerade Party, where they had celebrities come on in heavy disguises, and they had a panel of celebrities who had to try to guess who the celebrity was in the makeup. And they called me one day and asked me would I appear. They wanted to do something a little different. They wanted to do Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and they wanted to fool the panel by using two celebrities. And would I agree to come on? I said, well, sure, I'd love to come on. Who's the other celebrity? And they said, Edgar Bergen. And I almost dropped the telephone. Because I can't tell you what an inspiration this man was to me. And that was probably the highlight of my life, to actually meet him and to sit with him in the dressing room and to converse. I was so nervous when I opened the door and saw him sitting there, and Charlie was sitting in the corner, that I was in awe, and I didn't know what to say. So he put me at my ease, and finally I just had to be honest, and I said, Mr. Bergen, you have been my idol, my inspiration, the reason that I became a ventriloquist, and I'm so nervous sitting in this dressing room with you that I don't know what to talk about. And he said, just relax, and we'll just have a nice conversation. And then we began to converse, and he told me that he had a daughter named Candace, and I said I had a daughter named Stephanie, and he told me he was a pilot. I said, well, I'm a pilot, too. And we began to find out that we had so much in common, and it was a wonderful moment. Then we came on the stage, and when we finally took off the makeup and the audience recognized both of us, there was such thunderous applause, and I was standing right next to my idol, and drinking in that applause like rich wine. It was a magical night for me. I will never, ever forget it.
It's a wonderful story. We're talking with Paul Winchell here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJD 800. His new autobiography is out. It's called Winch. It is published by First Books. You've now written your autobiography. Why now? Why not earlier?
Well, for a long time I was considering it, and I didn't know that I was capable of writing, but I'm extremely pleased that I've been getting such good reviews, and that the book has been selling so nicely, and I'm thrilled to find that I have this capacity to actually sit down and write. But this is not really a usual celebrity type of a book. Even though I have many, many anecdotes in it with people like Frank Sinatra and personal meetings and experiences I had with Ronald Reagan and a lot of celebrities in show business, the thrust of the book is not one of the usual type of celebrity books. It's a rather deep book of a personal life, of a very, very difficult childhood that I experienced. And unfortunately, there are so many people out there like myself. The story is not unique, because when we open our eyes, we have no idea of who our caretakers are going to be and what kind of parents we are going to have. And I, unfortunately, happened to find myself with a mother who was a very, very disturbed woman. Apparently, her values came from her own upbringing and from her own family, and she was very cruel, and she used to whip the children, and she did terrible things, like she used God as a weapon to keep us in line, and threats with hell and damnation, and that's really the reason I wrote the book, hopefully, that parents could see that inadvertently they can cause a great deal of harm to their youngsters, not meaning it, but sometimes can give them problems that can last a lifetime, and that even later on, adult reasoning can fail to expunge all of those terrible, terrible threats. It was just a faulty religious indoctrination, and I was unfortunate enough to be one of those youngsters that experienced that. That's why I wrote the book.
Sometimes when children go through the type of things that you went through, they usually find an escape. A lot of the times with imaginary friends. Could this be the beginning of where your ventriloquism came from?
Exactly. You're very perceptive, Peter. That's exactly not only imaginary friends, but most of the ventriloquists that I know are the same type of people. They're withdrawn, they're inhibited, they're shy, they don't make friends very easily, and they find sort of an outlet in ventriloquism because there were so many things that I wanted to say as a youngster that I didn't have the courage to say or to stand up for myself, and I found an outlet through the dummy to be able to say so many of the things that were bottled up inside of me, and it was a marvelous way to release a lot of that emotion.
Even as an adult, working as a ventriloquist, do you find sometimes that the dummy can say things that Paul Winchell would not?
Oh, absolutely. When I was a young man, I say I was very shy. I had difficulty relating to girls and had trouble making a date frequently. And with the use of the dummy, I could get friendly with some of the girls who thought that I was kind of just kidding and clowning around. But throughout, it actually was a serious way for me to reach out and to make friends and to get rid of some of that shyness and inhibition. Ventriloquism really saved my life. If it didn't come along, I would have been stuck in that same situation. And it just allowed me to escape.
Now, you mentioned, do you have kids yourself?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. You mentioned the difficulties your mom had and that it was a result of problems that she had in her childhood.
Right.
Does that concern you, or did that concern you when you became a parent that you might be slipping into the same or going in the same direction that your mother may have gone in?
Well, absolutely, Edward. I went the opposite way because of that. It really worried me, and you find that many people who experience what I did seem to bend over backwards so that they don't do the same thing to their children, but it seems to be a psychological pattern that most psychologists agree that a child who was abused will wind up becoming an abusive parent. So if you don't watch it very carefully, there is a tendency to let that same thing out on your children, and that's what I really watched very, very carefully, that I wouldn't do that.
We are talking with Paul Winchell here on Montreal's News Talk Leader CJD 800. He is also the author of his new autobiography, which is called Winch, which is now in stores. It's published by First Books. He's also one of the great voice actors of all time. You created the voice for Tigger, and one of the things about the voices that you do, Tigger and all the others that you've done for Hanna-Barbera and the like, is with a Paul Winchell voice, and I guess it's the same thing could be said for people like Mel Blanc as well, with the voices that you used to do, not only was it a comedic voice, a voice for cartoons, but there was a certain amount of attitude in the type of voices you did.
Well, I had the pleasure of working with Mel Blanc and a lot of great, great voice people, June Foray and Dawes Butler and Stan Freeberg and really the greats in the voice business. And it was a wonderful experience. It does call for a certain kind of performing. besides just giving the voice. You have to develop the character and the attitude. And what's a great help is that when you first come in for the audition and the reading, they show you a lot of storyboards, and they show you the character, and they show you what it looks like, and they explain how he acts, and they give you a little background, and then you kind of dream on it and try to create the voice that would be appropriate for those drawings.
Okay. Now, I'm not going to do it, but I'm sure over the years, especially as the kids who watched your work have grown up, you must come in contact with a lot of people who, when they find out who you are, do your voices for you.
Oh, yes, yes. It's a wonderful reaction. I found one thing, that adults make a wonderful audience, but they are a little bit fickle. I mean, after they see a show, they've had enough, and they want to move on. But children sort of get an identification with the characters. They identify with you, and they want the repetition. They don't want something new. They feel more familiar with the same characters and the same repetition, and that's why I created this new network on computers for children, so that they could access it themselves, and they can watch my old shows. And I'm trying to get some colleagues of mine to come on with me. And it's a new thing on the computer. It's called video streaming. And you can actually watch the programs, and you can control the programs. You can control the audio. You can stop it. You can rewind it. You can do all things that you can do. And it's sort of interactive in a way, but it gives them a chance to see the type of shows that we used to do compared to what's on today for the youngsters. I mean, we used to do clean, wholesome type of programs, and today, my own opinion is that the choice that the children have on TV is really dreadful. Some of the things that I've seen that have been on during the hours when children can watch, I mean, the top show was Friends for how many years, and basically it's a bunch of young people who are sleeping around and they're having children and not getting married. And so what kind of values can we expect this generation to have by being exposed to that kind of programming? I felt it was just necessary to give them an opportunity to see the kind of shows that we used to do. So that's why I started this Paul Winchell Kid Network on computers.
And it's at your website, which is www.paulwinchell.com?
Well, that's my main website, right, which tells all about my background. But this one is actually Paul Winchell Kid Network. You just go on to pwkn.com.
P-W-K-N.
Yeah, Paul Winchell Kid Network, it stands for. And all you have to do is log on to pwkn.com, and up come all those shows, and you have your choice of all those programs.
Now, besides all this and the autobiography, which is now out, do you keep busy working? Are you still working?
Oh, yes. I'm quite busy now. I just finished an appearance that was very, very exciting. There's a gentleman by the name of Kelly Asbury who wrote a book about ventriloquists. I was very pleased to be part of it. He wrote about me and Bergen and Shari Lewis. It's called Dummy Days. And we just did a big show in Santa Monica, and we had hundreds and hundreds of people turn out. And Kelly, by the way, is the director of Shrek 2, the new one that just came out.
Right.
Very clever. And the book is Dummy Days. And what I was so pleased is that it brings back ventriloquism, which I feel is such a dying art. And I'm just hopeful that the exposure I'm now doing for the children, that they can watch a real ventriloquist, that maybe they can become inspired, and maybe we can keep the art alive.
And you say that ventriloquism doesn't get enough credit as a learning skill because, as you say, it uses both sides of your brain.
Absolutely. If you stop for one moment to consider what goes on in the mind of a ventriloquist, because he's got the dummy, sometimes maybe two dummies. He has to be thinking for the dummy and himself at exactly the same time. He has to be aware of what the dummy is doing and where the dummy is looking. And when he talks to the dummy, he has to be sure he uses the right voice and doesn't move his lips. And when the dummy speaks, he has to pull the string to open the mouth once for each syllable. There's an awful lot going on. And then, if he's right-handed, he's working the figure with the right hand, but everything else he is doing, of necessity, has to be done with the left hand. So the combination of all of this develops both sides of the brain, where most people who are either right or left-handed develop one side of the brain much more than the other. But I think that ventriloquism, as a type of a mental gymnastics, has the capacity to develop both sides of the brain and speed up the reflexes and the coordination. It's a fantastic study. The person who is interested in it doesn't necessarily have to want to become an entertainer, but can have an awful lot of fun with it. Even just kidding around with your friends and throwing your voice all over the place.
You know, I never thought about that issue of when you're using a dummy, you're using your dominant hand in the dummy's back, so everything else you're doing is with your non-dominant hand.
Oh, yeah. You become ambidextrous that way. And especially consider if you're using two dummies, one in each hand, now you're thinking for three people at the same time, and you have to be reacting to both of them and be aware of what both of them are doing, where both of them are looking, and if they speak to you, you're speaking, so you have to react appropriately to what they have just said. I mean, there's an awful lot going on there that really stimulates the brain.
Now, where are Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead Smith today?
They're right here. Want to talk to them?
Sure.
Oh, hiya, Peter. This is Jerry.
Yeah,
I'm sitting right here listening to you guys, and I want you to know that what Winchell is saying, I should get the credit. When you want to talk to Knucklehead, he's pestering me.
Okay.
Oh, hello there, Peter. Just listen, most people don't know this, you see, but when I went to Disney and we was doing the voice of Tigger, they said, why don't you use Knucklehead's verse? So he used my voice, and I became Tigger.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk to you, sir. As I mentioned earlier, I was always a big fan of your work, especially the stuff that you did when you worked with Hanna-Barbera. Dick Dastardly and Muttley are two of my favorite characters, and the entire Ant Hill mob, all seven of them.
And the Banana Splits.
Yeah. Just, you know, it's funny, just the other day I was singing the Banana Split theme song around the studio here and thinking about Flegel and some of the others.
Yeah, well, you know, the reason I called the autobiography Winch is because that's what Jerry used to call me all the time. Jerry always called me Winch, and Knucklehead used to call me Mr. Winkle. So, you see, you not only have to keep your characters separated, but you have to keep your mind aware so that the characters are consistent. I mean, Jerry can't call me Mr. Winkle, and Knucklehead can't call me Winch. They've got to remain in a certain part of my mind so that their characters are consistent.
It's an amazing art form, and you are helping to keep it alive. Again, the website is www.paulwinchell.com, and the other one you mentioned was
PWKN.com. Paul Winchell Kids Network.
And the book is called Winch. It is published by First Books. And I thank you very, very much, sir, for being on the program with us this evening.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for having me as your guest, Peter.